All right, as you find your seats again, I have some slides going here. I'll have them going between or during lunch so that you can see them. But these are publications that John has been involved in. And so his book is the next slide. That is John Woolman and the Government of Christ. And so he has written a lot of what he talks about in this paper in this book. Or a lot of what he talks about in what he's presenting here is in his book, in other words. And so that would be a good one to pick up if you want to learn more about this topic. And then he's also one of the editors and a contributor to the Quaker Studies series by Brill. And so some of the covers of those booklets are cycling through. And he's also an editor of the Quaker Religious Thought, which is a journal that I think comes out three times a year, maybe, and is kind of a helpful place for Quaker scholars to be able to publish their work on Quaker topics. So you can look for that. I don't know if you have it here in the library or anything, but it's also accessible online if you're interested in looking up anything else in Quaker studies that is kind of fun. So feel free to jot down those titles. I'll have them going again later on. So I'll just switch the PowerPoint and then we'll be set for our next session. Okay, so this is session 2, Woolman and Wilderness, A Quaker Sacramental Ecology by John Kirshner. In 1763, the New Jersey Quaker minister, tailor, and abolitionist John Woolman and two others, a companion and a guide, began a two-week trek into the Pennsylvania wilderness to visit the Native American town of Wyalusing. This trip took place during what in America became known as the French and Indian War, 1754 to 1763. A conflict between the two great European imperial powers. France and England, each power, among other things, vying for control of the Ohio River Valley, which you can see on the screen, which encompassed western Pennsylvania, and some native groups sided with the French, some sided with the English, some wished to be neutral. The constant pushing westward of the frontier by British settlers led to conflict with the Native American groups who felt their land was being invaded and their treaties transgressed. To make things more complicated, European settlers believed that the promise of fertile and plentiful land that had convinced them to leave their homelands and move their families to America was not as promised. Indeed, many of these European settlers were frustrated to learn, upon arrival in America, that the ownership of the land they had purchased was under dispute. These European immigrants had purchased the land from colonial land brokers, so they thought their claim was legitimate. Native Americans held a very different understanding of land ownership than did the Europeans, and resented the cheating that European brokers and proprietors used to expand their claims on traditionally Lenape, Conestoga, and Delaware lands. The dispute was ugly. There were massacres on all sides. Many of the European settlers on the frontier eventually fashioned a conquest theory of ownership, wherein those who could take the land by force had a sovereign claim to the land. Alongside that conquest theory of ownership was a racialized view of Native Americans, where the crimes of some Native Americans were attributed to all. For many settlers, there was no distinction between friendly and enemy Native Americans. The political background of Woolman's 1763 journey into the wilderness is helpful for understanding the situation Woolman was entering when he journeyed to Wyalusing. It helps to shatter those preconceptions and romantic notions that sometimes obscure contemporary understandings of the way people in centuries past experienced nature and wilderness. Going into the wilderness in the 18th century was not to be taken lightly. It was not like a week spent camping in Yellowstone, Yosemite, or some other national park today. It was dangerous and difficult, and despite it all, Woolman found it to be a journey through a physical landscape that offered sometimes troubling spiritual lessons with implications for the landscape of the soul. The idea that nature and place could say something about God, could in some way reflect God's nature, could provide lessons that are not confined to the material world, but that integrate the spiritual and the physical. That idea is not new. It is not particular to any group. It stretches the length of Christian history. For most of the first 1,000 years of Christian history, few Christians could read books about God. Without being able to read the Bible or other spiritual texts, many Christians looked to the physical and natural world around them to inspire the soul, to reflect back to them in ways obvious for all to see the ways of God. Ancient theologians said there is the book of Scripture, and there is the equally important and by far away more accessible book of nature. The faithful Christian could and must learn from both. But it was the book of nature that was readily available to us all. For them, the visible world mediated God's invisible presence and attributes. The view that physical objects and practices can reflect God is called sacramentalism. The capacity to see the holy and sacred in what is otherwise considered mundane. For these early Christians, the natural world was a vehicle to knowledge of God and God's will. The 4th century theologian Ephrem the Syrian, looked just like that, I'm pretty sure, was one of the many early church leaders who saw the natural world as a revelation of divine attributes. And even more than that, many believed nature was a sacred symbol for God. In every place, if you look, his symbol is there, Ephrem wrote. And when you read, you will find his types. For by him were created all creatures. And he engraved his symbols upon his possessions. When he created the world, he gazed at it and adorned it with his image. Ephrem taught his congregation that everywhere they looked, everywhere they went, they encountered the symbols and types of God. Not only was the created world good, the created world would lead the careful and faith-filled observer to God. The ubiquity of God's symbols across natural places meant that it was not only in cultivated and pristine environments that God would be recognized, but even the harsh, rough, and uncomfortable spaces could be reverenced because it exists, and because it exists, it was a doorway to the knowledge of God. Reading the book of nature was a sacred calling, made possible through the eyes of faith, but fully open for all to see. Woolman was aware of frontier hostilities between Native Americans and British settlers before he left the safety of his home, but felt a sense of divine leading to visit the natives of this land who dwell far back in the wilderness. On one particularly soggy day en route, Woolman recorded in his journal the severity of the mountain slope, downed logs that obstructed his path, and swamps he and his companions crossed. As he sat in his tent, unable to travel due to heavy rain, Woolman noted that the wetness of the season and the threat of hostilities made his journey more difficult than it would have been at any other time. However, he credited the political and environmental difficulties of traversing the wilderness with heightening his reliance on God and his concern for others. And as it pleased the Lord to make way for my going at a time when the troubles of war were increasing, and when by reason of much wet weather, traveling was more difficult than usual at that season, I looked upon it as a more favorable opportunity to season my mind and bring me into a nearer sympathy with the Native Americans. And as mine eye was to the great Father of Mercies, humbly desiring to learn what his will was concerning me, I was made quiet and content. That night, his guide's horse wandered off in the rain. Woolman's companion went in search of the horse and found it on its way back to Philadelphia. 7 hours later, he returned to camp with the horse, where the party spent another night because it was too late in the day to travel. Woolman paid attention to the physical realities of the wilderness around him and the hardships they occasioned. This is an important point. Woolman did not romanticize nature or wilderness. He did not and could not lose sight of wild spaces as life-threatening and potentially dangerous, as was so much life in the 18th century. And here is the point. Woolman's conviction that God could speak in and through nature was distinct from a view of nature as convenient, benevolent, or pleasant. Woolman did not idealize the wilderness like Henry David Thoreau would a century later. Even though some of the 19th century romantics like Thoreau looked back to Woolman as the type of simple agrarian spirituality they venerated, Woolman was not one of them. Woolman and many colonists of his generation had in their recent memories the dangerous and uncertain struggle with wilderness that their parents and grandparents had known as settlers in a new to them land. Moreover, colonists continued to hear accounts from the frontier where existence remained tenuous, and settlers struggled to survive, and where the expediency of survival was sometimes pitted against the teachings of one's religion, occasioning compromise and anxiety. For some Quaker meetings along the Pennsylvania frontier, day-to-day life meant negotiating the external dangers of attack and the more mundane uncertainties of securing a livelihood in a rough environment. For these scattered frontier Quakers, far from the security of Philadelphia, living on the margins of a colonial civilization sometimes meant living on the margins of Quaker discipline. Those Quaker meetings had to make their own way, even if it sometimes transgressed the sensibilities of Philadelphia Quakers. Thus, for many 18th century colonists, both Quaker and non-Quaker, the wilderness was an obstruction to be subdued, rather than Thoreau's mid-19th century romantic understanding of wilderness as a source of vigor, inspiration, and strength. Woolman's response to wilderness was distinct from many of his fellow colonists because he did not view the wilderness as an obstruction, but neither did he idealize it as an objective purveyor of wisdom like Thoreau would. Woolman's interactions with wilderness coincide with what Belden Lane has called a phenomenological perception of nature. That is, Woolman did not view nature as inherently one thing or another, neither an obstruction like the other colonists, nor an innate source of vigor like Thoreau. Rather, nature and wilderness simply were. And because of the empirical fact of their existence, they were agents of providence and solicited a response that reflected God's provision for all beings. Two other views of nature contrast with Woolman's phenomenological view. One is the cultural perception of nature and physical place that views geography as a blank slate, something with no meaning outside of what human beings attribute to it. In the cultural perception of nature, the individual's or group's personal affinities and dispositions are projected onto nature in a way that turns nature into nothing other than the observer's projected desire. A modern example of this cultural perception would be those who see economic utility as the reason for nature's existence, and hence practices like mountaintop removal are believed to be justified. Cultural perceptions of nature and place need not be destructive, as is the case in the example of those mentalities that justify mountaintop removal. Cultural perceptions could lead to neutral or protective interactions with place. The key feature of cultural perceptions is that place is understood as only carrying meaning and value that is attributed to it by human beings, without regard to the specific features of the place itself. It is a view that starts with the human person's or community's needs and projects those needs onto physical places. More positively, the cultural perception of place contends that all physical spaces can be sacred insofar as they reflect the social construction of sacredness. Cultural perceptions of place recognize that nature does not carry a specific predetermined and inherent meaning apart from the cultural construction of meaning that is projected onto it. The second view of geography and nature that Woolman rejected was what Belden Lane has called environmental determinism, which contrasts the cultural perception of nature in that it assigns a predetermined and fixed inherent meaning to nature and place. It is deterministic. This view claims that human views of nature and place have no bearing on the meaning and interpretation of places. Rather, nature and place will evoke unbidden and predetermined responses. However, changing interpretations of nature across cultures and history would suggest that simply coming into contact with a geography does not carry the same meaning across contexts. A grove of oak trees, for example, may have been important and appreciated to New England Puritans, but the meanings they found there would have been different from the meaning an oak grove gave to Celtic Christians in pre-modern Britain, who carried the memory and legacy of Druid spirituality, with its veneration of oak groves as spiritual places. In the view of environmental determinism, simply going to a natural place would occasion a predetermined spiritual transformation. So entering the wilderness would occasion growth and vitality simply by being there, without any conscious effort or changes within the individual. It supports the illusion that changing places is the simplest way of changing ourselves, and that the natural world promises automatic transformations. However, while there may not be a set of predetermined and preordained meanings that correspond with natural settings. The example of Woolman teaches us that nature's power of suggestion is great. Unlike cultural perceptions, that view wilderness as a blank slate onto which the subject projects their own meanings, and unlike the environmental determinism that assigns predefined and inherent meanings to natural objects, supposedly independent of human perception, a phenomenological perception of wilderness is never a purely cognitive process. It is not simply a projection. Neither is it human-assigned meaning. Woolman's experiences in the wild demonstrate the intersubjectivity that exists between the human and the natural world, in which there is a reciprocity between subjects. From this phenomenological perspective, the wild is present to and with the human subject only to the extent that the human participates in the various affordances it offers, responding to the striking geographical features it projects. Woolman brought to the wilderness, as he did to all physical space, an apophatic spirituality in which the divine will could fill his own. This apophatic spirituality can be seen in one of Woolman's favorite terms, resignation. For Woolman, resignation did not mean giving up. It did not mean ceasing human effort. What Woolman called resignation was the spiritual practice of becoming one with God's will. It meant to recognize that human beings are complicated and conflicted, and that their truest selves are realized when they trust God and seek to pursue in their daily lives all those things that comprise the righteous and just life. Resignation was a precondition for true discernment. Woolman's practice of resignation operated on the assumption that there were supernatural powers at work within the natural world, and that the most authentic response of the human being to God was to see the physical world and the spiritual world as a piece. In resignation or yieldedness to God, Woolman believed the individual could be transformed from the false self, lost in a spiritual wilderness of alienation from God, into a true self that could identify in the physical wilderness the continuous revelations of God, which gave form and structure to the human experience. Thus, Woolman did not idealize the wilderness as inherently positive or having any inherent meaning at all, beyond its existence as a member of creation, of which he was also a member. He did not gloss over the physical difficulties and dangers wilderness occasioned. However, in his apophatic spirituality, he discerned in the wilderness particular affordances of place that led him to reflect inwardly on the presence of external stimuli, and therein to learn new spiritual insights. The day after their guide's horse went on its escapade in the rain, the party set off again for Wyalusing. Woolman recorded in his journal, "The sun appearing, we set forward, and as I rode over the barren hills, my meditations were on the alterations of the circumstances of the natives of this land since the coming in of the English." Woolman observed that Native Americans had lost to the English the best lands and their own livelihoods, so that they were forced to pass over mountains, swamps, and barren deserts where traveling is very troublesome in order to trade with the English. Wilderness phenomena was present to Woolman as the phenomena itself. Swamps, mountains, and barren landscapes maintained their physical integrity. He did not try to imagine his way through the physical objects in search of metaphors for independence and vitality like the transcendentalists would a century later. To do so would have diminished the injustice of Native American displacement. To project a meaning onto nature that does not reflect the physical reality of nature would have been to reduce nature itself to a purely human construction, because no honest person who had any other options could idealize the rain-soaked, mosquito-infested, dangerous, and difficult realities of traversing, living in, and finding a livelihood in fierce landscapes. It was the poor and the oppressed that were forced to live with those realities in the 18th century. Rather, the wilderness was present to Woolman as it really was, even though interpreted through the individuality of his own apophatic spirituality. The affordances of the wilderness landscape illumined economic injustice and, as J. Miller argues, destabilized and reordered his sense of self, human relations, and his understanding of divine will for human organization. The wilderness was both threatening and instructive, and so Woolman did not avoid it. He did not view it as only an obstruction. Rather, wilderness was a present subject with him in his desire to be transformed by God, and therefore would be used by God to extend compassion and spiritual insight. After noting the barrenness of the wilderness landscape and the consequences of British colonial policy on Native Americans, Woolman examined his own complicity in injustice. My own will and desires being now very much broken, and my heart with much earnestness turned to the Lord, to whom alone I looked for help in the dangers before me. And a weighty and heavenly care came over my mind, and love filled my heart toward all humankind, in which I felt a strong engagement that we might be obedient to the Lord while in tender mercies he is yet calling to us. And here I was led into a close, laborious inquiry whether I, as an individual, kept clear from all things which tended to stir up or were connected with wars. And my heart was deeply concerned that in future I might in all things keep steadily to the pure truth and live and walk in the plainness and simplicity of a sincere follower of Christ. On this journey into the wilderness, Woolman's understanding of faithfulness to God's will was expanded into new arenas of personal piety and economic justice. Wilderness affordances were not incidental to the spiritual insights he discerned and the extension of compassion he experienced. The specificity of the wilderness landscape and his own spirituality were both prerequisite for the experience. The approach to wilderness places I have identified in Woolman is distinct from the perception of wilderness by other colonists, which was often unambiguously negative. The whole colonial endeavor was predicated on the notion that distant wilderness places could be cultivated for lucrative resources to enrich the homeland. When William Penn received the royal charter for what would become Pennsylvania in 1681, about the time John Woolman's grandfather emigrated to the colonies, Penn simultaneously became the single largest landlord in the British Empire. In order to pay for his settlement and some of his vast debts, he needed to sell his land and expand the colonial infrastructure inland. The entrepreneurial land speculators who purchased land from Penn set up towns between the port city of Philadelphia and the frontier. These land speculators then recruited settlers to purchase smaller tracts from them and to set about the work of harvesting Pennsylvania's natural bounty to trade back to the port cities and onto major European capitals. Penn's descendants succeeded him as executors of the colony and continued to view the wilderness as something to be tamed. The Quaker colony was not alone in this. The Puritan vision for New England was an errand unto the wilderness that entailed turning the wilderness into a city on a hill. A vision that was spiritual and metaphorical, but also evocative of the designs that would be exerted on the landscape itself. Colonialist ventures were founded on the assumption that the wilderness was either an obstruction to economic expansion or a resource to be tamed and commodified. Over the course of the 18th century, colonial markets became seen as places of commercial expansion by homeland mercantilists and industrialists. Extensive transatlantic shipping networks grew to accommodate the movement of natural resources from colonial ports to Europe, and in return, European luxuries and fashions were shipped back to colonial ports for consumption and distribution inland. If the moneyed colonialist interests wanted to commodify the wilderness and its resources, individual colonists knew their survival depended on subduing it. Quakers generally agreed that wilderness places needed cultivation. Carla Girona's work on Quaker dream culture has found that colonial Quaker dreams often featured visions in which wilderness places were groomed into pastures with fences and tamed. In Quaker spiritual writings, the wilderness was synonymous with depravity and willful spiritual regression. And here, woman's complexities challenge generalizations and sweeping characterizations. For woman, too, used the term wilderness as a metaphor to describe Quaker spiritual laxity and divine displeasure. A trust is committed to us, a great and weighty trust, to which our diligent attention is necessary. Wherever the active members of this visible gathered church use themselves to that which is against the purity of our principles, it appears to be a breach of this trust. And one step backwards toward the wilderness, one step towards undoing what God in infinite love hath done through his faithful servants in a work of several ages, and appears like laying the foundation for future sufferings. For woman, a spiritual wilderness is a place to avoid. Like the Hebrew people wandering in the desert because they failed to fulfill what God required of them, so Quakers could experience a spiritual wandering in a wilderness of their own making if they did not live up to their end of their covenant with God. If they participated in oppression, if they were more focused on their pocketbooks than on God's voice, if the divinely appointed designs of their liberation from persecution and ecclesial oppression in England were not realized in the life of their community, then they had already entered a wilderness place. But even in this spiritual metaphor, wilderness is not evil. It is an accurate reflection of the spiritual reality. It does not call for a response of destroying the wilderness. It calls for a conversion of the heart so that the lessons of the wilderness can be learned. Woolman's warning about wilderness, spiritual wilderness, is mild compared to his peers, like John Churchman, who understood spiritual wilderness to be a type of punishment that purified the wayward through their suffering. These views reflect the cultural assumptions about wilderness most Quakers maintained. Woolman believed that if people were faithful to God's intent for social organization, less people would live in colonial or European cities. Fewer would be involved in the transatlantic economy. And more people would undertake what Woolman called the sweet employment of husbandry. For Woolman, this agrarian vision was an eschatological one, in which Isaiah's peaceable kingdom would be enacted on earth, and the social harmony that characterized the Garden of Eden would be restored on earth. For 18th century patriots like Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine, the image of sturdy yeomen working the pastoral landscape was grounded in a secular vision of historical progress, not a religious one of fulfilling God's will. Yet, in either Woolman's religious vision or the Jeffersonian one, the ideal society to be established in America would be one of subsistence farmers engaged in animal husbandry. For many colonists, a pastoral agrarian vision was the equilibrium between the two extreme poles of wilderness and European-style cities. The agrarian ideal tamed the wilderness, but did not fall into the dislocation of industrializing urban centers. In the context of the colonial endeavor, then, wilderness places were usually seen as hindrances in need of cultivation. For colonists, it was cultivation, not wilderness, that was the ideal. Where colonists differed was on the type of cultivation desired, and the degree to which European-style development should be emulated in the colonies. This context helps to highlight two important aspects of Woolman's perspective on wilderness that was different from many of his fellow colonists. First, while Woolman did view farming as a noble employment, he did not reject wilderness places as merely hindrances and obstructions. In his apophatic spirituality, the affordances of every landscape could be divinely filled with meaning, and so could become active subjects, evoking insights unavailable in another setting. The wilderness, then, was not kept at arm's length as that which needed to be tamed, but was taken into himself as a fellow participant in God's creative paradigm, and thus as a fellow shaper of meaning and a co-interpreter of the divine will. J. Miller says, "Woolman does not separate who he is from where he is." Later on his journey in Wyalusing, Woolman wrote about a rainstorm he and his fellow travelers encountered, which was so heavy that it beat through our tent and wet us and our baggage. As a result of the storm, their journey was further mired by the large number of trees that fell across the path. The wetness of the path, the downed trees, and more swamps led Woolman to write, "We got through with extreme difficulty," to put it mildly, it sounds like. And directly after this description of the environmental conditions, Woolman wrote, "I had this day often to consider myself as a sojourner in this world and a belief in the all-sufficiency of God to support his people in their pilgrimage felt comfortable to me, and I was industriously employed to get to a state of perfect resignation." Severe wilderness conditions led Woolman to consider the transitory nature of human pursuits and fostered a spiritual conviction that abandoning oneself to the will of God and to the establishment of God's will on earth was the goal of human existence. The trees, rain, and swamps destabilized the logistics of the trip to Wyalusing, and corresponded with a spiritual destabilization of woman's sense of self that deepened his dependence on God. For woman, destabilization was not to be avoided, and thus the wilderness was not to be avoided, because it was in such experiences that one's vision was expanded. While the wilderness was a place of physical obstruction, the wilderness could be a place of instruction and transformation. What was required for all these transformations was not something external to the human subject, but an internal disposition of openness to the affordances of every place, a sacramentality that responds to the affordances of every place as a place of humility and wonder, struggle and the sacred, weeping and confession, because these are all responses to the presence of God. It's the assumption that every journey is a journey into God, because every physical place, as wild and brutal as it may be, is also a place that already bears God's presence. This is not to deny the danger and trouble of fierce landscapes. Neither is it to romanticize nature in ways that were only possible among the philosophical elite. Rather, it is to honestly respond to the geographic features that exist and to honestly reflect on the less than ideal, less than romantic contours of the landscape of the human soul. A second difference between Woolman and many other colonists was that he did not wish to subdue or eradicate the wilderness. He thought that the British expansion into the wilderness of his day was already an economic injustice to the Native American population, and that if colonists rejected materialism, they would be able to subsist comfortably on modest farms with no need for expansion into wild places. Thus, in Woolman's vision for colonial America, the wilderness would always be near at hand. When Woolman returned home from his journey to Wyalusing, he again recounted in his journal the difficulties occasioned by the wilderness. The bushes, trees across the path, and even rattlesnakes. He then reflected, "People who have never been in such places have but an imperfect idea of them. But I was not only taught patience, but also made thankful to God, who thus led me about and instructed me that I might have a quick and lively feeling of the afflictions of my fellow creatures whose situation in life is difficult." Woolman did not overlook the wilderness landscape, but neither did he assign it a purely metaphorical value of his own determination. Rather, the specificity of the wilderness landscape was spiritually instructive and stayed with him as a permanent part of his understanding of the life of faith. In this way, Woolman's spirituality was always a spirituality of place, a habit of being, such that any physical landscape could become a heavenly gateway. Woolman's perspective represents a significant difference from those colonists whose commercial exploits sought to carve up the wilderness, whose agrarian vision wanted to subdue it, or who thought of the wilderness as a problem to be solved. Woolman's view of the wilderness differs significantly from Thoreau's. Thoreau saw in the wilderness the source of human vitality. Thoreau said that the wilderness was to the human spirit what the she-wolf who suckled Romulus and Remus was in Roman legend. Thus, Thoreau would say, All good things are wild and free. Woman would not attach such weight to wilderness itself. There is nothing inherently good in the wilderness. The wilderness was difficult and dangerous. However, woman found in the real difficulties of wild places affordances that extended his compassion and heightened his sensitivity to divine leading. The only good that could come from the wilderness was that of being resigned to God's will. Woman woman was not the only one who took dangerous journeys into the wilderness. He was also a farmer. He had an orchard. He observed the landscape wherever he went. This spiritual sensitivity and awareness of landscape could reveal insights while tending the orchard or walking the city street. There was no need to attribute to wilderness an inherent spiritual meaning, such that one must leave their domestic surroundings to enter into the wild in search of spiritual wisdom, because the spiritual habit of being that was resigned to God's will found God's presence everywhere. The suggestive power of nature was great, but the affordances of each place, each location, each vista, from the most mundane to the magnificent, were places for the receptive soul to live in communion with the God who is already active and present in every place. However, one suspects that woman felt it inevitable that God would call everyone into wilderness places. The particularity of the wilderness landscape could afford an intersubjectivity of being unavailable in other landscapes. The wilderness wayfarer would thus find new spiritual insights in barren landscapes, insights as threatening and destabilizing to the spiritual self as the wilderness was to the body. For woman, though, the goal was to be resigned to whatever journey God called one to, and then to accept the affordances of those landscapes, people, and situations as gifts from God. Woman's encounter with the wild is useful for a Quaker sacramental ecology because it provides an alternative perspective to those encounters that view wilderness as an instrument toward spiritual self-fulfillment, or that view wilderness as primarily a means to inner strength and peace, or that look to wilderness for its utility and material value. In contrast, woman's experience of destabilization in the wilderness directed his attention outside of himself to a heightened sense of dependency on God and to the extension of social compassion. To walk through every place, natural or constructed, wilderness or domestic, busy or barren, comforting or challenging, serene or obscene, to walk through all these spaces open to the affordances of every landscape and every place is to foster the sacramentality that takes the realities of place seriously, as they are, which is to honor and respect each place. And it is to be challenged and destabilized in a way that admits growth, conversion, and conviction. An ecology like woman's resists the temptation to turn ecological concern as something that only happens out there in far off places to the concern for other people. Because out there is right here. And right here, wherever that may be, is a holy place. because God already fills every landscape. I'm grateful to share this holy place and this holy moment with you all. And I'm wondering what rises in you as you hear these words.
One time, it was about 20 years ago, my wife and I took a trip to Death Valley. And on our return, we stopped at a place called Mono Lake to have our lunch. It was a convenient place. And we decided to take a walk down the boardwalk to the shoreline. The lake had actually been filling up in those days, so what had been a place with a bunch of sycamore trees had been drowned by the lake, so they had died and they were sitting out there. And we got down, well, when we were in the parking lot, I said to her, "Do you want me to bring the telescope?" And she said, "No." So we walked down to the landing spot, and we looked out, and on these dead trees, there were a bunch of yellow-headed blackbirds sitting on it. So it was really a gorgeous thing, and she really wanted to look at them up close, and she asked me if I'd go get the telescope, and I said, "No, I offered to bring it down here. If you want it, you go get it, you know." So she went back to get the telescope, and I was sitting there, and it was a Sunday, and it was about the time that my meeting would be having meeting for worship, so I decided to have some worship. So I did my usual, and then I sat straight up and clasped my hands and closed my eyes, and after a couple of moments, I felt like something was staring at me, and I opened my eye, and there was this magpie that was about 2 feet from my face just staring at me intently. And when I opened up, he sort of startled, and when I looked at him, I got this message: "Why are you sitting here with your eyes closed instead of looking at my creation?" And it was such a breathtaking spot. And sometimes in the wilderness, that's what happens with me. I get these great insights of inspiration of just the magnificence and the hugeness of the creation and our little small part in it. But I did feel that connection, that I was part of that wonder that I was looking at.
I really appreciate you and John bringing us this side of John Wolman that I hadn't been aware of before. But it's so much a part of my life to experience the sense of spirit in nature. It's very exciting to think of his differentiation between the Thoreau kind of idealizing or romanticizing nature and Wolman seeing it as beautiful and as brutal as it is, and yet seeing it as a window to opening ourselves up to new truths. And that feels so powerful to me to expand that sense of the romanticization of nature, but grow into it as something larger than who we are, to take us to a place where we can be.
I'm not remembering the author's. I may be getting the author's name wrong, but some of you may have heard of the book Solaris. By Stanislaw Lem, I think. He's a Polish author. It's a science fiction book, and I actually liked the newer movie with George Clooney better than I liked the book. But there's a line that's in both, there are actually two movies, both the movies and the book, that I think is really pinging for me in this conversation, which is, he says, "We don't want other worlds, we want mirrors." And thinking about how, for the most part, the world I live in today, which is the outgrowth of European colonialism, is a mirror. And 99% of my life is lived in a human-created environment. Like, this is all very human-created. It's built by humans, for humans. And so the encounter with the wilderness isn't God, but it's not us. It is not a mirror. It is a window, and it's the magpie looking at us. It is something else, and it does not reflect our values or norms or needs. It just is, and that is pretty powerful.
Yeah, what really stood out to me from what John wrote here was the kind of along those lines is the intersubjectivity piece of, yes, the natural world is there and we can use it as this window to see God better, but it's also not just an instrument for us to view God. That's not its purpose. It's just there in itself, and we can be in a relationship with those other creatures and other entities in the natural world by encountering them as themselves, and we can learn about God through them just like we do through other people, or maybe differently, importantly differently from how we learn about God through other people. But it's not just there for us to have these wilderness encounters with God, but by placing ourselves in those places, we can often have those encounters with God by relating to those creatures. So the relational piece, I think, is important and something that that I'll be taking with me from what John shared here. Other thoughts and comments?
This is maybe a little off the subject, but I got very hung up right at the beginning. I won't say it made it difficult to listen to the rest of it, but because I did listen, but John's choice of words when he was just first characterizing the dispute between, you know, colonialism and the taking of Native American land, where he said that the Native Americans felt that their lands were being invaded and treaties being abrogated. And that's a fact. That wasn't a feeling that they had. And it just got me thinking about, and he goes on to, you know, he does say more about that, but I just thought, what an odd choice of words. I don't know if that could get back to him. I don't know if it's already like in his book or something, but I would just use a different word. And it made me reflect about us here today on stolen land also, that I think more people are getting in the habit of at least acknowledging that at the outset of, you know, presentations and stuff, which is sort of a, you know, can be a feel-good kind of tradition, but I think that it also has some meaning. So
I suspect that John meant that kind of facetiously, of like, oh yeah, they felt that way, that's how the colonists interpreted it. But yeah, so I probably didn't read it with the proper inflection. So sorry about that. And but I think we can definitely pass that on to him, and that's very important to definitely state straight out that that wasn't just a feeling, that was a truthful experience of people. And that's, you know, part of our story as Quakers, as well as the rest of our American society. So definitely important to remind ourselves of that frequently and often and solidly and move in another direction. Thank you.
I was struck by the idea of what John Woolman called resignation, which, as you underlined, it did not mean indifference or giving up, but resistance in some sense, or endurance, or, yeah. A form of strength that does not express itself in panic or but in trusting God, and that's a message that we all need today, and in some way, a very small way, I saw it realized in what happened this weekend. I'm not going to go into details.
I know on occasions when I've gone into the wilderness over the years, in addition to being just in awe of the beauty and brutality of it, and I've contemplated trying to get inner peace, but I've also felt very expendable, it's a very humbling experience it puts me more in touch with my place in creation, which is very small, So when I compare that feeling of being aware of my my biological expendability, with comparing that to his sense of resignation on a spiritual level, and that humility, to me, that's an interesting comparison. The resignation is a call to action in a sense, mm-hmm. but it comes out of that humility of sensing one's. When the story you tell, I get the idea that he's thinking he may not survive the trip. And I've had that experience in nature on at least one occasion where I wasn't sure I was going to get out alive. And it changes your perspective.
I think it's amazing how there's something so paradoxically important about feeling so small and insignificant and expendable to the cosmic system that does connect us and make us able to do this work that we're called to do. So let that be our challenge as friends. I think we're, Shelley, did you have something else? I thought about it, but didn't want to do too much self-promotion, right? But I'll promote Shelley. Shelley and I are going to be sharing at the Friends World Committee for Consultation and leading a workshop and an interest group about creation care, sustainability, how we as friends are called to move forward on this topic in maybe bigger or faster steps than we have in the past, hopefully. So that's going to be in March at the FWCC annual section of the Americas gathering, and it's in Kansas City, Missouri. So if you all are planning to attend, that would be great if you want to come to the workshop and the interest group, or if you want to hear the results from that. We could probably get those to you somehow. So Shelley Tannenbaum is the director of Quaker Earth Care Witness. So she has some credentials in this area. And Adrian Halverstadt, is that his name? From Kansas, I believe, from Mid-America Yearly Meeting, probably.
Barclay.
He teaches at Barclay College, is going to be also leading the workshop with us. So it feels like there's some momentum among friends right now to maybe take this stuff seriously and not just, you know, do the romanticized version of what Woolman's talking about, but to really get both of those sides of the coin put together and to recognize the importance of not continuing to just collude with the society that we are in here in the United States. So you can be in prayer for that workshop and discussion, that the Spirit is very active and present with the people that are gathered at those meetings and emboldening us to take the next steps that we're called to take. So I'm hopeful that we'll come out of that with some concrete things that we as the Society of Friends can do, which I think is first and foremost that transformation of the heart that Woolman talks about, and that we can't let it stop there. We can't let it be okay to just be comfortable with our transformed hearts in our little meeting houses. But it's going to take some active work beyond that to allow ourselves to be invited out into further action from that place of insignificance and humility and knowing who we are as tiny little beings in the cosmos and beloved of the Creator in relationship with the rest of creation. So hopefully that's inspiring to you all, that we have this work in front of us, and it's a moment where we have this big, huge possibility in front of us. So I hope that that inspires you and gives you courage for those next steps. So, one other comment here.
So here I am looking at sacramental ecology. I'm probably the only one here who grew up in Hawaii, which has an entirely different history. Hawaii began as a rock in the middle of the ocean, with nothing there, just rock. But eventually, animals and vegetation flew in, washed in. And then eventually, a couple thousand years ago, two waves of human Polynesians came by. And of course, when the Polynesians came, they wiped out some of the kinds of animal life. You know, ground-running birds, easy to catch and eat. Then eventually, the first Europeans came. And they came, and they landed on Kauai. And in that town, that village, there was not a baby born alive for 50 years. Again, because we didn't look to see what we were doing. And so I cry over what has been lost, but that's what we have. I didn't do it, except that I got to grow up there, so I took advantage of things. This is not a personal history that is current with most people here, but it gives you a different perspective of what humans have done and what we need to do to prevent utter disaster.
Yeah, remembering those histories and our part in that is a huge part of the work that we have in front of us, I think, and allowing that to be reinterpreted back to ourselves rather than this glorious manifest destiny as recognizing all the problems that we caused, some of them inadvertently and some of them advertently, if that's a word. But and so as friends, I think that's a big part of our work is awareness of those kinds of stories of our land and our people and the impact that we've had and doing the work of repairing, reconciling, making peace, as we like to do, or we like to say that we do as friends. So doing that work is really important. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. I've had the opportunity over the last couple of years to do a fair amount of reading about European and British history in particular. And there was a chain of events that started with the English Reformation that caused a great deal of social disruption in England and a great deal of dislocation and suffering because people were basically, people who had traditionally been doing subsistence farming across England were forced off of the land and became vagabonds and homeless people. At the beginning of the 17th century, England, King James and England, the English policymakers realized that they could export their problems to the colonies, which of course happened and transferred a great deal of the desperation to the American shores. And it also, part of the transformation also involved a transformation of the economic system from a feudal subsistence society to a capitalistic acquisitive society, which became, for whatever reasons, very successful in its own right, but disruptive and continued to spread a significant level of misery, which in a way self-sustained it and makes it almost insurmountable to change today. So in John Kirshner's exploration, we're looking at a snapshot of this transformation that began at least 200 years prior to Woolman's life and continues today. And I think one of the really insurmountable parts of that is how do we understand it conceptually, but how do we get in touch with the spirituality that Woolman represents? I think it's a great challenge. I certainly don't claim to be anywhere close to it, and I think our entire mental structure is so cognitive at this point and so academic that it's very difficult to get in touch with a woman's sense of direct spirituality. So anyway, those are some of the thoughts that are flitting around for me.
I was happy to hear that woman used the term, this ancient Quaker concept of resignation. It seems to be something that's been completely lost in the 20th century among Quakers. This resignation, which really is a submission to the will of God, becoming voluntary subjects to what God wants and not what our own specific egos want. And I think it's very important to emphasize that, because it really has been something that's been lost, and yet it was at the core, the very core of the first Quakers.
All right, well, thank you, friends, for sharing these great thoughts. I believe we're going to lunch, so.
Yeah, let me make a transition. I thought I would give you a little preview of the next session. In case you are interested, John Kirshner takes off in quite a different direction in his exploration of Woolman and the contemporaneous Quakers of the middle of the 18th century by exploring their dream lives. So I want you to know about that in advance in case you are interested in what's coming next. I want to also say that John Kirshner prepared a sermon for tomorrow morning, and he sent the text ahead together with this package. And I want to emphasize that it's very much a sermon and not a lecture. I think today's presentation is much more in the lecture format of academic. The sermon is, I thought, quite significant, and I encourage you, if you're not able to attend, to at least check our website, which will be posting that sermon, and it may be posting everything today too, I'm not sure, but it will be posting the sermon tomorrow, assuming the equipment works. And if you don't want to take that chance that it fails, make a point to come. I thought it's one of the nicer sermons I've come across, and well worth listening, and both integrated with today's presentation, but also putting it on a spiritual level rather than an academic presentation. So those are two opportunities to avail yourself of. I wanted to introduce our co-pastor team that has recently arrived at the beginning of January at Berkeley Friends Church. Faith Kelly I want to say Brian Young, why am I stuck on that? Micah Bales is the fellow with the red hair in the back. I encourage you to get acquainted with them. Mike has been working really hard since he's arrived in town, getting established in a full-time job in addition to sharing this part-time position with Faith. So they have a lot on their hands and two young children. I thought we might ask Faith to lead us in prayer prior to our lunch meal.
God, we thank you for all your many blessings, for this time together, for the materials that John has prepared, for your spirit here among us today. We ask that you continue to be with us as we go throughout this day. Open our minds and our hearts to what you would have us to hear. We ask you to please be with John and his wife as they head to the hospital and are expecting their new little one. May they also feel your peace and presence. Lord, we're very aware of the many hands that have made possible the food we are about to eat. Those people who grew it, picked it, brought it to the store, brought it here to us, and Lord, we thank you for that.